Well, hello once again, and welcome to the 2001 Socrates Award Lecture. And briefly, the Socrates Award is an award that the students in the Principles of Environmental Toxicology class give every year by their vote on the Poison of the Year. And the Poison of the Year this year award goes to chemical and biological warfare agents. It's obviously been in the news lately and on the top of a lot of folks' minds. We're very fortunate today to have a guest speaker that's going to deliver the Socrates Award lecture. Our guest speaker is Eric Crotty. Eric is from the Monterey Institute of International Studies and the Center for Nonproliferation Studies at the Monterey Institute. He is a member of the Chemical Biological Warfare Nonproliferation Project. Eric got his master's degree at the University of San Francisco in Asia-Pacific Studies, and he was a National Security Education Program fellow at that time. He also has a significant science background. Actually, he was even a TA in the chemistry department there for a while, and so he has a unique mix of scientific background and what I call a military history background as well in this area. He's had numerous publications over his recent career in the field of military medicine, chemical biological warfare, and some of the agricultural and biological terrorism that makes up today's newspapers subjects. He is somewhat fluent in Chinese in that he's a translator. He has a focus area in the Asia Pacific. He's appeared as well on CNN and National Public Radio and writes for magazines such as Jane's Defense and The Guardian, which kind of talk about issues related to this subject area. He's also coming out with a book here shortly. Actually, it appears next month. That is, the name of this book is Chemical and Biological Warfare, A Primer for Concerned Citizens. So with that, let me invite Eric to the stage. Thank you very much, Eric, for joining us this morning, and we look forward to your presentation.
Thank you very much, Professor. Appreciate it. Thank you very much for being here. I'd like to thank Professor Miller very much and the University of Idaho. This is a real pleasure and a privilege to be here to talk about something that's near and dear to me. It's a little bit obscure, perhaps, in some ways, but what I found is, as a failed chemist myself, that this puts together a lot of different disciplines, and perhaps in your studies, and you'd probably be able to tell me more about some of the mechanisms that go on in terms of toxicology as well as infectious disease. But basically, chemical warfare is the use of toxicology and anger, without a better way of phrasing it. And then the rest of the problem is really one of engineering. How do you deliver it to the battlefield if you're in a warfare context? If you're a terrorist, even if it's for a small, isolated targeting process, how are you going to affect that successfully, if at all? So that's the type of thing that we try to research as best we can at the Monterey Institute, and this is how I make myself relatively gainfully employed, but it's also intensely interesting. I really wouldn't want to do anything else. When we go back to the old days, and Fritz Haber is a very complicated character. Of course, the Haber-Bosch process that has his name of fixing nitrogen from the atmosphere is something that mankind still owes a debt because that's enabled for fertilizing soils ever since he devised this scheme in about 1914, 1915. But he was also considered the father of modern chemical warfare. What he has to say here is encapsulates in many ways what chemical warfare really is. You know, chemical warfare, biological warfare were not necessarily devised out of some hand-wringing motion or some dastardly means to be more cruel. During World War I, they knew very much about cruelty and how warfare was going. In the first 3 or 4 months of World War I, as the historian John Keegan reminds us, 400,000 men died in just a matter of months. And that was before the entry of any use of chemical warfare. As a matter of fact, chemical warfare really resulted in just about 5% of overall casualties. 3% roughly were actually mortality. But what he has to say here is very instructive. He's saying this is a more of a psychological effect, if anything. In the chemical warfare, when you're talking about tons of agent, what we're trying to do is to incapacitate the enemy. Not necessarily to kill, but to incapacitate. And we'll see more about this later on. Why? Because an injured soldier is more of a hindrance to the enemy than a dead one. One injured soldier requires medical care, logistics, and there's also a psychological and a morale component to this injury. And this is what many of the early and later chemical warfare strategists were thinking of when they devised means to use chemicals in a warfare environment. Terrorists, to a limited degree, may be going for some more lethality rather than just going for injury, say, just for the sake of. There are quite a few agents to look at if you really want to take the chemical warfare discipline as a whole, and these are just some of them, but these are the major categories. Some of these names you'll immediately recognize as being classic poison, some not so much. Olfactory agents, this seems rather obscure, but as a matter of fact, this was an important part of early and later research in chemical warfare. Basically, how to stink the enemy into some kind of incapacitation. But lung irritants are the classics. Vesicants, cyanide, nerve, we're familiar with these. And to a certain degree, we can call harassing agents can be used as tear gas in a civilian, but also in a military context, which is now banned, by the way. Psychoincapacitants, BZ is your classic cholinergic compound similar to atropine. Herbicides, certainly Agent Orange is a classic example. But what I'm going to talk about are just really the main categories of what I think are really important from a perspective of chemical warfare writ large and also chemical terrorism. That is, what's really most important? What's something that we should want to hold on to? And of course, the first major attack was the use of chlorine. It was not the first chemical warfare attack. It was the first one that served to have any utility on the battlefield. Now, some of the numbers at Ypres in April 15, this is when Fritz Haber and, as a matter of fact, Otto Hahn helped to fill some of the chlorine canisters, devised a means where they took about half of Germany's supply of chlorine at that time, somewhere around 500 tons, and they manhandled all those cylinders up to the front. Now, this is quite an operational undertaking, as you could imagine. You also have to open these up at the right time. As soon as the gas evolves out of the tank, it suddenly cools, of course, and the brass nozzle sometimes would freeze, and soldiers would be stuck there with all this gas billowing about and not sure what to do and became casualties themselves. It was successful because the Allies really didn't know anything about this, even though they may have had some intelligence to pick up this picture. By the time it was released and went towards the Algerians and the Canadians, who were really the objects of the first attack, it probably killed at least 800 men and injured probably a few thousand. The number of 5,000 dead is probably an exaggeration. But if we look at the way chlorine behaves in the water system and moisture, one can already see that there's some reactions going on that we might want to think about also in a terrorism context. For example, adding acid to bleach is a good way to generate chlorine gas. Adding ammonia to bleach is a good way to produce aminochlorines. Chloramines are very, very toxic. And this is something from a hazardous materials perspective that's of great import. But also there was a 1988, there was a terrorist, or perhaps you should call him a wannabe terrorist, he wasn't very successful, but Dean Harvey Hicks put two canisters of bleach and ammonia in the trunk of his car. He proceeded to drive it up near a federal building, then he loaded up that car with explosives. What was his intent? Well, it seems to me that looking at the scheme that we've just seen, generating chloramines from such an approach was his intent. Would it have been successful? It's hard to say. But again, this is what we need to think about. We also have to be very creative when we try to anticipate the next threat. Now, World War I, I just want to take a quick note of the major agents involved, the ones that really caused the most casualties. And when I say casualties, I include both wounded and dead. If you look at these agents, which of these do you think is the most effective? Well, as I just mentioned earlier, from a military perspective, something that injures a large number of groups of people, of soldiers, may be more effective than perhaps limited but highly lethal use of gas. And this is, in fact, what happened. Phosgene, for example, caused 80% of the deaths caused by gas, but really was not as an effective agent as mustard. And certainly chlorine ceased to be a very significant agent very early on in the war. That's why mustard's called, at least at that time, the king of chemical warfare agents. We can also look at the toxicities. What makes a good chemical warfare agent? Well, toxicology is only part of the puzzle because we have to deliver it in some fashion. So if we can see now the hydrogen cyanide and its The toxicity of cyanide is a little hard to estimate. That's why I asterisked it as an oddball. It doesn't really behave Haber's law. But as we look at this and these numbers here, we can see, well, obviously, VX is the most toxic. But is it the easiest to deliver? Well, we'll see about that. Hydrogen cyanide seems like a very much least toxic, and it's also very difficult to deliver because of its high volatility. So now we look at the volatility. We see that, again, hydrogen cyanide is at the top of the list. So the types of agents that serve to be most militarily useful, whether through experimentation or actual use on the battlefield, really tend to be those that have, of course, high toxicity, but also have physical properties that lend themselves to weaponization. Weaponization, I mean basically filling a canister with the substance in question. So solids, for example, how would you deliver a solid in the battlefield is a very vexing engineering problem. Whereas a liquid with a simple explosive, whether it be an artillery shell or a jerry-rigged device, is something that's much more straightforward. Hydrogen cyanide, again, from both the battlefield and terrorist perspective, is worth commenting a little bit further. In World War I, hydrogen cyanide never was really used in an effective way. Nazi Germany and the Soviet Red Army, the United States, the Japanese military, all experimented with hydrogen cyanide in various forms as a way to deliver it in high enough concentrations, and this is the key, the high enough concentrations on a battlefield at a given time to create the kind of casualties that they thought necessary. None were really that successful, arguably, although some say that the Red Army came pretty close. But what about from a terrorist perspective? Well, we've already seen some reports that the Taliban were looking to use some kind of a binary system, and we'll talk more about binaries later, but basically putting two relatively innocuous compounds together. Sodium cyanide is not innocuous, but in this solid form, it's much easier to handle. And then sulfuric acid, while being caustic in a dilute form, doesn't pose that much of a problem. Combine them and you generate hydrogen cyanide gas. You do so in such a way that you can do this in an improvised manner. In fact, Aum Shinrikyo, the cult that attacked the subway with nerve agent in 1995, devised such a system. One bag of dilute sulfuric acid, one bag of sodium or potassium cyanide, doesn't matter. And they would combine with a timing device, and the components would mix, and you generated hydrogen cyanide. And in an enclosed area, this could probably generate a lot of lethal gas. In an open area, it's not entirely certain how many casualties will result. So from a hazardous materials perspective, while this is not necessarily from a warfare, I mean, militaries are not necessarily going to be looking towards hazardous materials, terrorists might. Does chlorine move around in this country? And yes, it sure does. And hundreds of thousands of pounds every day go through train and to a lesser extent on truck. And this is something that railroads, transport authorities are very concerned about, and certainly FBI is concerned about as well. Hydrogen sulfide is another hazardous gas that's relatively common in this country, mostly as a byproduct. But if you think about it, hydrogen sulfide is actually more toxic than cyanide. Now, there was a case back in, I'm trying to say, mid-90s, where the FBI investigated some wannabe armored car thieves. Now, their plan was basically to drive up next to one of these propane gas tanks, set off an explosion as a diversion, and then go rob the armored car. Now, it turned out that there was also word that hydrogen sulfide was also stored at the same facility. Could it have been that their plan was to detonate a bomb, release hydrogen sulfide gas in the hopes of killing as many people as possible, and then to effect the robbery? I mean, if you look at the numbers, I mean, that's certainly a plausible case. Hydrogen sulfide in many ways is really just about the same, if not more. Methyl isocyanate, now the compound that caused thousands of deaths in Bhopal, India, is even more toxic still. But there was no real evidence that this is what they were thinking. In other words, just because it's there doesn't mean that it's necessarily a terrorist threat. It's something we just need to keep in the back of our minds. As it turns out, the conspirators were indicted on other charges not having to do with chemical agents or weapons of mass destruction. Now, vesicants, of course, are extremely important from a military perspective, less important from a terrorist point of view, however. Why is that? We've already talked about how mustard is the king of the chemical warfare agents. Why? Because it causes so many casualties and that are debilitating to the enemy forces. Lewisite, in many ways, is very much like mustard. It's more rapidly acting, is more toxic, but it also has the same amount of persistency. If you compare the vapor pressure, say, of a lightweight oil and water, maybe mustard and Lewisite are somewhere in between that. So it will stay in the environment for a very long time. So you have contact casualties with the agent that persists in the environment, in the soil, for days, weeks, even months, depending. Then you also get the vapors, depending on the temperature, that can also create casualties. And these blister agents, if you're familiar with the chemistry, you can see that many of them share some common features, namely that the mustard's there. You replace that chloride ion, by the way, with a hydroxyl group, and it's not toxic at all. The early investigators, when these things appeared, there was very much a surprise at how toxic thiodiglycol, say, being reacted with hydrochloric acid, produced such a toxic compound. Nitrogen mustard, by the way, was probably developed through pharmaceutical research in Czechoslovakia in the 20s and 30s during the investigation of tertiary amino compounds and also quaternary compounds, which are so important, of course. Now, Lewisite, of course, is an arsenical, and there are many of them. Lewisite is really but one example, but Lewisite's a classic. And so sulfur mustard, Lewisite are really your classic blister agents. Let's talk a little bit more about sulfur mustard and why it's so potent. And this is on the left, you see some experimental, somebody actually volunteered for this, by the way. You can see the really pronounced edematic pustule there. Now, and on the right there is a photograph from an Iranian casualty. Now, mustard was effective to the extent that it was as a chemical warfare agent in World War I, and was also much more effective as an agent during the Iran-Iraq War. In the Iran-Iraq War from 1980 to 1988, somewhere in the neighborhood of 1 million Iranians died. And I'm not quite sure how many Iraqis, but it's clearly in the tens and hundreds of thousands. Mustard was a significant part of that campaign because it really helped the Iraqis fend off human wave attacks by the Iranians. Iranian Basij volunteers had no problem with minefields. They had no problem with machine gun nests. They did have a problem with gas. Let's talk a little bit more about how sulfur reacts in a chemical or biochemical system. This approach here probably helps to explain it better, is the formation of the sulfonium ion, the reactive species that then goes on to react with some of your vital components in the body. Including guanine, say, but there could also be other reactions too that we're just not very familiar with yet, and the mechanisms haven't really been explained to my satisfaction. But through the cyclization and through the combining and cross-linking of DNA components, nucleic acids, we can already see that this is not a very happy situation. So when you have these DNA link cross-linkages, DNA breakages, there are a couple of ways to approach this. Either way, you end up with cell death. And many times the cell death actually comes from the inside. Sulfur on dead skin is not necessarily that much of a consequence. But it sure is when it gets into the living skin and the basal layers, and particularly in the thin epidermis in the under the arm and the inguinal region. This also helps to sort of flow chart hexose monophosphate shunt, which has been proposed by others as being the mechanism, and it's satisfying. But again, the cell dies, autolysis, release of proteases, and what do you get? You get edematic fluid. Now, what happens often in battlefield casualties is you're not necessarily going to get very obvious blisters, at least not at first. What you're going to get is this redness of where the exposed regions are. Now, on this slide, it may not be as obvious. You may have to look carefully. But you can see under his arm the red erythematic region. And if you think about it, and if you're a soldier and you're out in the field, there are two areas that you do not want to have painful, itching, blister-forming areas of injury. And that's under the arms and in the groin, because that's where a lot of your motion is. This soldier is not going to be of very much use to you. In fact, he's going to be a logistical burden, as I mentioned before, and it's also a medical problem. Mustard does not kill as often as the other agents do, but there are some very serious consequences to exposure to vapor. The pseudomembrane formation, particularly in the upper respiratory system, is usually where most of the casualties leading to death are caused. Usually it's not in the lower parts of the lung unless we're talking about a huge amount of exposure, in which case the situation doesn't look good either. But if we look at this and we sort of see how the tissue there, as you can see in the center, this is from a World War I casualty, by the way. You can see that the tissue has already started to slough off, falls into the bronchioles, and then you get lung collapse and suffocation. Before any of the other toxicological problems manifest themselves, this person has already asphyxiated, which is, again, the essence of chemical warfare, which is dry land drownings, which is how they describe the lung irritants injury. The lungs filled up with fluid, and they suffocated. Well, in a sense, this achieved a similar purpose in terms of the lethal quantities required. You can compare this, by the way, when we get to infectious disease, and biological warfare, of course, is public health in reverse, isn't it? Some of the same pathological manifestations can be seen, say, in diphtheria. And this is a fatal case here. You also see the pseudomembrane formation. Now, the eye injury is also a very classic part of mustard agent poisoning. It's not always permanent. As a matter of fact, most tend to recover. Some of the more serious may need corrective surgery, or even contact lenses can sometimes correct long-term sequelae. But as we can see here, it's extremely painful. And this is a classic picture, and there's also a famous painting by Sargent. But if we look here, what's going on? Well, we have one soldier leading the other. When mustard gets into the eyes and you get the rapid and extremely painful conjunctivitis, it feels as though you have ground glass in your eyes. And at that point, you don't want to open those up for anything. And so basically, you cover them up. And of course, essentially, you're temporarily blinded. Adolf Hitler wrote about this, too, in his memoirs, if you can call them that. He was gassed with mustard himself. The long term for the eye injury is serious, but again, it's not always permanent, not as some might lead you to believe. And then in terms of the summary of the toxicity of mustard, it's important to realize that constant exposure to a lot of these compounds is really the key, and not necessarily a single exposure. Mustard is the same way. A lot of the data that we have comes from workers who help fill munitions with practically no protective equipment, whether it be in the United States, France, and certainly wartime Japan, where they produced a lot of sulfur mustard, and the workers there had very little in the way of protection. Lewisite, we don't have as much information on, and certainly much of the information is really from animal studies, but it formed a significant part of the Soviet Union chemical arsenal, and to a lesser degree, part of the United States. It's very much a much fast actor. No one in the presence of Lewisite would probably want to stick around for very long because it's that potent. It also creates the same arithmatic reactions, blisters, and certainly reaction to the eyes, but also in the sinus. So it's both going to be a harassing as well as a extremely high casualty agent. And of course, death is always a possibility, as it is with mustard, depending on the amount of vapor exposure. These agents can be delivered as an aerosol, sure, but they're also more often delivered in such a way that contact hazard is the key. So forces will have to maneuver around, or if they maneuver through, they suffer the consequences. And in many ways, this is another essential part of the goals in chemical warfare. This will give you an example of how these were meant to be delivered. These pictures are a little bit fuzzy. These came from a Chinese book on chemical weapons, actually, when they took pictures at the Shikhani exhibition in Russia in 1987. But you can see here that there's quite a lot of agent for this aerial munition that would be dropped by a bomber or perhaps a fighter bomber. And it would spew the agent out over a particular area on troop concentrations or in an infrastructure that you want to deny the enemy. So we have two things going on: direct casualties, deny of territory, canalization of forces, particularly airfields, train yards, ports. These are the areas that you try to immobilize the enemy, whether from a defensive or offensive action. Now, there's a mustard-lewisite mixture going on here. And you may be kind of curious as to why that is. Does anyone have any ideas, perhaps, of why you would mix mustard with lewisite? Well, we have a combined action, actually, of both compounds. They're not exactly synergistic, but they have some of the same types of toxicological kinetics. you're damaging certainly tissues from both an arsenical and also a sulfonium ion. But from the physical properties itself, and particularly in the former Soviet Union that was used to fighting in winter, mixing with the lewisite, a chlorinated organic compound essentially, helped bring the freezing temperature down below zero. In other words, mustard below 20 is going to be a very useless agent if it stays frozen.
Along that line, the residual of activity of this stuff is not going to be high. Is that correct?
Or? Well, actually, it will be. And this is another key to this problem. So not only do enemy forces have to deal with the contamination hazard of one, but now they have two agents to think of. So lewisite and mustard, as I mentioned earlier, are relatively persistent, and it really depends on the environmental conditions, but they can last for days, months, depending on the weather. And this can always be a hazard. Let's say you're marching through the snow contaminated with something like this, even if it were at a very low temperature, very low vapor pressure. You get inside a tent, eventually that stuff is going to warm off of your boots. And then turns out that a lot of Iranian casualties were the same way. When they transported Iranian casualties from the Iran-Iraq war, off gases of mustard were a contamination hazard to the crews flying them to Germany and to Japan for treatment. It's something just to keep in mind. So we should never downplay the role of decontamination and also area avoidance. Here's another idea of an even taller and more striking picture here. If you note the gentleman there for reference, this is 1,500 kilograms of the 636 kilograms fill of mustard lewisite. And this was a typical Soviet munition. We've talked a lot about blister agents and how important they are. I want to stick to nerve agents more also from the military, but also the terrorist potential. But not to minimize the importance of mustard too. From a military perspective. From terrorism, nerve agents are probably going to be the key. Now this picture here, by the way, was a laboratory accident where a gentleman was using a pipette, and he was working with Soman, which is a classic nerve agent, and he was using his mouth to siphon it out. How that actually happened, we're not entirely sure. He washed his mouth out with the emergency fountain, went to the next room, he told the attending physicians and his commanding officers that he may have been exposed, and he fell down. He was treated and doesn't seem to have suffered long-term effects. These photographs are taken over weeks and weeks, where as you can see that the meiosis, his pupils are down to a fine point, even in a darkened room on top. So these were taken in a dark, say in a dark closet with a flash, and it took many, many weeks for him to finally recover, as you see at the bottom, where his pupils had returned to basically normal function. But this sort of speaks to the long-term nature of nerve agent injury. It's not necessarily life-threatening, but it can be very disturbing. The key to some of these nerve agents is not so much their toxicity, which it is, but also their refractory to treatment. And some of the more bad actors in this regard to remember are Soman and GF. Soman was an agent that the Soviet Union weaponized to a significant degree. GF was a compound that the Iraqis produced in sort of a quick mix, semi-binary fashion. One key is that the aging group. If you take a look at that molecule, you'll see that some of these less than stable conformations, when they behave into the system, when they inhibit the enzyme, as we see later on, have a tendency to come off and will reveal a group that will prevent hydrolysis. And this is what we call aging, is when acetylcholinesterase is inhibited, but again is refractory to any kind of treatment or hydrolysis in the body. So essentially, that enzyme is kaput. B agents look more along the lines of some of the thioesters used as pesticides later on. In fact, were invented, VX was, by Imperial Chemical Industry, by Ranjit Ghosh. He came up with this compound that seemed to be extremely toxic to mammals and realized that this didn't have a lot of commercial potential, so he gave it to the British government. And the British government didn't really have much use for it. They already had a fair amount of nerve agent, so they gave it to the United States. Somewhere along the lines, the Soviet Union came up with this formula, probably through theft, but perhaps also by reading the literature. As you can see, their structure is very similar, and sure enough, the physical and toxicological properties are very, very close. I just want to explain very briefly the inhibition of enzymes by nerve agents. And we were talking about the aging group a little bit earlier. But the key to the immediate inhibition of the enzyme is the leaving group. And in this case, it's fluorine. It could be another nucleophilic group like cyanide in the case of Taboon. But modern nerve agents, particularly sarin, that was used in the Tokyo subway, Soman, which is also a fluorinated methyl monophosphonate, these are the types of compounds that will behave in this manner. As you can see, they attack a serine group in the enzyme. They bind with the enzyme, and just like a lock and key, when you break off that lock, is no longer usable, is it? And in many ways, this should be really viewed as a three-dimensional, and this two-dimensional really doesn't do it justice. But by having inhibited acetylcholinesterase, acetylcholine levels increase, and it starts down to a spiral where your increased acetylcholine increases more activity for the lungs to try and keep up, more acetylene, acetylcholine is produced, and your enzymes are inhibited, and it leads to the symptoms of nerve agent exposure, which I'll get into. So man is particularly age-prone, I say, again, because of that group, the pinocolyl alcohol group. When that comes off that molecule now, we don't really have a way to get that phosphorylated group off of that enzyme. Some oximes, some treatments are better than others for treating SOMAN. Some are better in the case of, say, VX or sarin. But again, SOMAN is something that was in the back of our minds during the Gulf War. We knew that Saddam had been looking towards producing SOMAN, and we looked at what our troop concentrations were, and we realized that we were up against a bad actor, and that's one of the reasons why they prescribed carbamates as pretreatment during the Gulf War, because of the threat from SOMAN. As it turned out, Iraq really had a problem getting their hands on pinocolyl alcohol, so they never really produced very much in the way of SOMAN. Now let's look at the symptoms of nerve agents exposure. And again, we also might want to bear in mind just how toxic nerve agents are compared to mustard. If I were to guess, about 2 grams, roughly, 2 grams of mustard is about the average lethal dose for most adults, compared to VX, which is 10 milligrams through the skin. Right? Sarin's around 100 milligrams. So there's really a huge difference, and it's extremely toxic and extremely hazardous, not only just to the enemy, but also to whoever is employing them on the battlefield, by the way. So now, nerve agent intoxication, these are the typical results of intoxication. But of course, the most disturbing are when it gets down to paralysis, respiratory failure. But there's also a massive amount, because we all those acetylcholine levels go up, what happens? You have all this autonomic response too. You have secretions of mucus, especially salivation, and these things will block up your upper respiratory tract. More often than not, serious nerve agent exposures are going to be created in such a way that the actual enzyme inhibition, when it comes down to the respiratory system or even the central nervous system, is not nearly as severe as the immediate problem of clearing up the upper respiratory tract because of all the fluid that occludes the respiratory system. Here's some more examples of some V agent and also some variations on the physical theme. We already talked about the different toxicities but also the physical properties of these compounds. Compared to sarin and SOMAN, VX is probably even much, much thicker and much more persistent. It doesn't really have as much vapor pressure. For some reason, the Soviet Union decided, however, to take their V agent and then thicken it with a polymer. Why this was done probably had more to do with making sure that it remained where it was put in case of attacking, say, infrastructure targets, airfields. It'd be much harder to decontaminate. But what happens now after the Chemical Weapons Convention and the arrangements that we've made with the former Soviet Union, we have to decontaminate this. So it's not really very straightforward. So far, what we could do is take the agent itself, react it with some products, and then we could make some non-toxic byproducts and get rid of them. However, the physical properties of the polymer itself is such that you have to add one more component, and this is where N-methylpyrrolidinone comes into play as a way to solve through all that mess. So in other words, depending on where you are and what agent you're talking about, and also how it was engineered in the system may also determine how you can get rid of the stuff.
How about enzymatic
They've been talking about enzymatic, but I think has more to do with cost than I mean, on paper it works just fine, but when we're talking about tons and tons of this stuff, the Soviet Union had anywhere 40,000 agent tons. Now we still possess somewhere around 30,000 agent tons of agents of all types. But when you're talking about quantities of that degree, you really also have to think about economy and what's the safest way of getting rid of it as well. Obviously, if you don't solve through that polymer problem, you're going to have pockets of V agent still in solution, and you have to somehow remediate that. Now, I'll talk a little bit about doctrine, and to the extent that we had one in the United States, I think it might be of some interest. To get back to the theme of, from a military perspective, not necessarily terrorist, but a military perspective, the idea is to incapacitate, not necessarily kill. This wasn't because there was any great humane regard on the part of U.S. military commanders, is that you can save the amount of munition that you have. So when 100 milligrams meter per cubic meter per minute would be enough to cause lethal casualties, half of that would cause certainly the same number of incapacitated soldiers, which is the goal in the first place. And so they use these rather complicated tables, and one supposes that you'd have to be out there with your finger to the wind, also trying to get an idea of, well, are we in an inversion layer, are we in a neutral or lapse, what's the wind, what's the temperature, to get the numbers of shells for any given area. But this is what was basically used as part of the operational doctrine, anyway, for using sarin by the U.S. military. And here's a design of one. This is a rather well-posed photograph. They conveniently had a see-through panel here on the old Honest John warhead. And these are sarin bomblets about grapefruit size. Sarin, as I mentioned earlier, is much more volatile than BX and certainly more volatile than mustard. So getting it down to the target presents some problems from long range. So if you enclose it into a space and have that drip towards the targeted concentrations of your enemy, and then they burst open, that's a more efficient use of your agent. Finally, the actual aerodynamics of the spheres themselves produce a so-called Magnus effect, and these would scatter over a larger area, getting wider coverage. And of course, the multiple rocket or multiple launch rocket system is a very significant part of the U.S. military, and Soviet and Chinese as well, by the way. And these were also lended to the use of sarin, GB is the code, and BX. Many of these are in storage in places like Tooele, Utah, and they used an aluminum warhead that wasn't very well made. And as a result, many are leaking. So this is, of course, an obvious immediate hazard to not only people working there, but potentially to those living in the area, although I think that's a little exaggerated. And here's a rare photo, actually. This is from the Sino-Vietnamese War. But this is what a multiple launch rocket system does, is you have a lot of tubes to fire a lot of rockets at any given time. This provides a lot of coverage, and which is why this system is generally regarded as the one of the main key components of any chemical warfare capacity, is the system. And unfortunately, this type of system, the BM-21, is found all around the world. Binary shells is a more advanced way of delivering agent. In the United States, the color photo there, basically is combining two components, DF, which is a difluoro methyl phosphonate, with an alcohol. I was talking about pinacolyl alcohol earlier. In this case, it was isopropyl alcohol. They can be combined in the shell, and the actual physical launching and spinning of the projectile would mix the two components, and about 70% yield of sarin is produced. A fuse would shoot it out the back at about perhaps the right time above the target. We ended up producing quite a few of these in the late 80s until we stood them down. On the left is a conceptual diagram from a Chinese book on chemical weapons. I'm not sure whose that is. And here's another conceptual idea that the Chinese had of one component B and component A, one below. They would mix in the front and then they'd go out the back. But it's the same system. In Iraq, what they did was actually had one of their major components, DF, that is difluoro methyl phosphonate, in a tank, and then mixed the alcohols by hand. Now you can imagine that this was obviously sort of an ad hoc procedure, presenting a lot of risk to those involved. But it also produced two things, produced sarin and GF, because they use a combination of isopropyl alcohol and cyclohexanol. These are the types of things we might want to be considering in the terrorist context if such binary devices were to be used in an impromptu fashion. Quickly through the cycloincapacitants, we had weaponized really only one major compound, that was BZ. Jimson's weed is a classic presentation of naturally occurring scopolamine. BZ functions a lot like atropine. The danger of BZ primarily is from heat exposure. As soon as this anticholinergic compound turns off your sweat glands, you have to be extremely careful. Plus, there's a lot of CNS activity that generates a lot of psychological hallucinations. And in the U.S. military, it's finally decided that its unpredictability did not make it a very useful weapon. Eventually, it was destroyed. As you can see, some of the compounds are not very far removed from the same group, atropine being the classic. And since we were talking about, and I was honored here with the name of Socrates, Socrates, when he took hemlock, was basically taking in some of these toxic compounds of the piperidine, but also the conine compounds. The variations of this basic component were also investigated as psychoincapacitants. East German chemical military literature looks to serenil as one of the more commonly investigated, and the United States military investigated that as well. And he also noted that as you add different groups and conducted the experiments, you'd find that you can increase the incapacitation of these without necessarily increasing their toxicity. LSD, mescaline, and quite a few others were also investigated. These are some of the antidote regimes. We can talk about this more later, but primarily for nerve agents, atropine is really the drug of choice. It dries up the secretions, I was saying, was one of the more immediate problems. It doesn't solve many of the muscular fasciculations, twitching, or the meiotic problem, but those are not life-threatening. And finally, an oxime can be used to help restore enzyme. But depending on which nerve agent you're talking about, oximes may not be very effective. But atropine certainly is the immediate treatment of choice and is presented here in the Mark I kit for the U.S. military, and the Chinese have a version as well. And here the Chinese are using an old-style gravity syringe to introduce oxime. We've talked a lot about the chemical warfare agents, the major ones, just as a quick review. If we're to remember anything, really, vesicants are an important part of a military arsenal, not necessarily for terrorists. Nerve agents are significant as well, not only from a large military operation perspective, but also for isolated attacks, as was witnessed in 1995 in Tokyo. I'm going to take the remaining time, if I can, and talk about biological warfare to the extent that we can from maybe perhaps a toxicological point of view. It's really infectious disease, of course, public health in reverse. But, you know, we can also put some dosages to some of these agents as well. Now, as you'll see, you may see botulinum A, the toxin that's isolated from the gram-positive, you know, the spore former, Clostridium botulinum, of which there's the type A is commonly found out in the West, including in Idaho. The inhaled lethal dose is probably around 5 micrograms, which is I have some numbers wrong there. But in the event, botulinum A should be called about 5 micrograms. You may see much lower figures, but some of the experiments that have been done by the U.S. military suggest that it's a little bit larger than that. But certainly staphylococcal enterotoxin B and Bacillus anthracis, tularensis, the cause of agent tularemia, and Coxiella burnetii, Q fever. Now, certainly the dosages, if you look at these, in terms at least of from one degree to the next, they're extremely potent, if only because in the case of Coxiella burnetii, only one organism can cause disease in many individuals. So this is a real striking part of this business, is just how infectious some of these materials are. And an organism like Bacillus anthracis actually takes probably at least hundreds, if not thousands, of spores to initiate disease in most people. These are things that you have to think about in terms of the actual threat. Another part is, are these lethal or are these incapacitating? And in terms of Coxiella burnetii, it's rarely lethal. Tularemia can be, depending. Certainly anthrax is extremely lethal, which is perhaps why it's the terrorist organism of choice, perhaps. Botulinum A is also extremely lethal, as we all know, just from the public health point of view. But it's also relatively hard to isolate and to keep pure. Now look at these numbers here from the old studies that were done in the United States. You see the Chinese and others have basically used the same numbers. The key is in the case of Pasteurella, now Francisella tularensis, causative agent tularemia. You notice that the particle size, how important it is, and particularly in these animal studies. Down below you'll see that the number of cells needed to cause disease is directly proportional to the size of the particles generated. And this is the key of biological warfare. Tularemia was an important part of the Soviet and U.S. arsenals primarily because it infected most it came into contact with, and you didn't need much to cause infection. Somewhere between 10 and 50 organisms. Professor?
Is tularemia also vectored?
It is. In nature, tularemia is usually transmitted by the tick. It can also be present through the zoonotic pool in rabbits. And so rabbit fever, of course, is the classic description of disease. But this also is a model for biological warfare in a sense. If you're skinning a rabbit that's infected with tularemia, if you note that while you're dressing it, there's a fair amount of physical and kinetic energy involved. This can generate enough aerosol to generate infections into those who are. So it's not necessarily cuts on your hands, because that's another easy way to get tularemia, but also by just inhaling the aerosols. And that's the key, of course, not only to a lot of chemical warfare agents, but especially so in biological warfare, which everything about biological warfare, except for perhaps T2 toxin, the mycotoxin, everything about it really leads to and is caused by inhalation of the particles itself, small enough to reach the alveoli to initiate infection. Here's an aerosol field trial done by the U.S. government back in the 1950s. What's interesting about this particular trial is that this was done from a minesweeper off the coast using a simulant, what they call Bacillus globigii, now it's Bacillus licheniformis, something similar to Bacillus subtilis. It's basically an innocuous spore former. They had about 120 gallons of about a billion or more organisms per milliliter. And they cruised up and down this coast at about 5 miles an hour using off-the-shelf spraying equipment. This generated not a very efficient, but still it was a sizable amount of particles within the 1 to 10 micron range, which is really what you want to get, and covered a significant area territory with large numbers of spores being found, as you can see, in about 23 square mile. But spores were found in the hundreds from about 100 square miles. This is very large coverage, and in terms of a terrorist attack, this is among the ones that probably keeps me up at night. Because again, this is done in 1950, and one can imagine from agricultural sprayers and other techniques that have been devised since then off the shelf, something improvised could plausibly be done. Smallpox, of course, is one of the major diseases that's a major threat in the biological warfare area. It's not necessarily most likely, because as far as we know, only two places have the smallpox virus. But the contagiousness of smallpox, the fact it can be delivered as an aerosol, but also secondary transmission by aerosol, is key to its transmission. This would be, of course, a major catastrophe, since really very few of us are really inoculated in any way against smallpox. Certainly anyone born in the late 60s and onward certainly have not been vaccinated with the vaccinia vaccine. Now, we can also talk about, in terms of biological warfare, into some of the toxin mechanisms to try and keep within our theme. And sure enough, you'll see a lot of these compounds presented in the AB toxin form. Now, we've seen some of this already. We see it in this case of botulinum, where you have a B and an A component. Let's just arbitrarily call B the one that binds with the cell receptor and allows ingress for the A component to do its dirty work. Ricin does this, ricin toxin from the castor bean plant. Diphtheria toxin also functions this way, and also the cholera toxin for that matter. So it's sort of interesting to find that many of these same toxic mechanisms are really part of the infectious disease picture. And that includes biological warfare. In terms of anthrax, for example, anthrax disease is really mediated by the toxin that's produced by the organism. It's also a group AB type of toxin, in this case a lethal factor and protective antigen. And in this complex, finds its way and kills living cells, one helping the other. Now, we're going to talk about some past cases here and just perhaps have an idea of what I mean about evidence from a biological weapons convention point of view, and also how do you know that a biological warfare event has actually occurred. Now, in 1979, a pathologist working at the Sverdlovsk Hospital did a first necropsy on approximately 44 individuals. And the first necropsy that she performed, she saw this so-called cardinal's cap. She recalled from her training that one of the few things that really caused this was experimental anthrax infection in monkeys. So she had a presumptive diagnosis in 1979 already that inhalation anthrax was causing deaths in the Siberian town of Sverdlovsk. Now, contrast that with people later on who have been talking about how, well, perhaps a number of spores were necessary to cause this. Recall that I was talking about how Bacillus anthracis generally causes disease in individuals, and we can only estimate in hundreds of thousands of spores. Now, from some calculations of using a Gaussian plume model from the outbreak in 1979 in Sverdlovsk, some suggest perhaps only 9 spores were necessary. Well, I'll leave it to you to conclude as to how one can be so precise from those numbers. The upshot of it is by using a small number like 9 spores that caused the infection in 2 individuals at Sverdlovsk, by going through the extrapolation of the data to conclude that only milligrams of anthrax were actually involved in the original incident. Whereas, in fact, I think most people would consider that the Sverdlovsk outbreak was a clear case of where Soviet biological warfare activity was going on. It was offensive, and that there were probably grams, if not hundreds of grams, of material involved. Because what Messelson and others have done is looked at graphs like this and taken a look at what really occurred from experimental data in monkeys, and then extrapolated from that data from the Sverdlovsk incident to come up with a figure of 9 spores. The basic point I'm trying to make here is that we need to be a little bit more humble than this in terms of trying to come up with numbers, because we just don't know. We really don't have a lot of the data available. And to draw major conclusions from animal data to the human case is also a very parlous task. Here's another example of accumulated doses in monkeys. As you can see, at the lowest on the run 5, we're still looking at the dosage into thousands of spores, if not in the upper hundreds. These are really the only hard numbers that we really have. And so in regard to the recent cases of anthrax, I think we also have to be very skeptical about drawing major conclusions about how many spores are necessary just because of all the different factors involved. Here's another case of biological warfare that actually was not, and that was the siege of Stalingrad in 1942-43. Now, Ken Alabek, who used to be former deputy director of the Soviet Biological Warfare Program, suggests that the Soviet Red Army used tularemia as a weapon against Wehrmacht forces. I disagree, and there are reasons for this. Just as in wars throughout the millennia, disease has been a major part of it. And Francisella tularensis is endemic to the regions of Scandinavia and Eurasia, and always have been and probably always will. Ken Alabek says that, well, there are thousands and thousands of infections during the siege of Stalingrad I. An older Soviet Red Army gentleman that he talked to basically told him, yes, the Soviet Red Army used tularemia as a weapon. He also noted that there was high pulmonary involvement with many of the casualties during the Battle of Stalingrad. We talked about how biological warfare is essentially an aerosol problem, and how infectivity is really cause mass casualties has to be brought down to the lower alveoli in small particles. Well, if you have a large pulmonary involvement, then perhaps this is something that's a signature of biological warfare. One of the problems with Ken Alabek's thesis is that there were about 14,000 tularemia cases that had already presented themselves in Rostov before the German Wehrmacht got anywhere near the front. So either the Red Army preemptively hit its own citizens for some reason, were rather impropitious in the use of their agent, and how it was delivered was never described. Or perhaps more likely, as is in the case of a lot of biological warfare allegations, this was a case of natural occurrence. And here's another case to present during this time, is actually the pulmonary involvement was really higher in a lot of cases. Why? Francisella tularensis, the organism, can find itself in a number of ways, not only in the pools of rodents, rabbits, but also from contaminated water and contaminated particles or fomites. In the case of Scandinavia and also in Eurasia, thrashing of grass that had been grown where there had been a lot of rodents that had been providing the enzootic pool for the organism could also present itself onto these particles. And as you thrash hay and you make beddings, this generates a lot of inhalable aerosols. And this is probably the model for infection for many of the soldiers during the Battle of Stalingrad, because in those days, and you're a soldier, and even now, if you want to make a bed, you make it out of what? Straw. Or you make something out of hay for bedding or for other insulation purposes. But there are other means of transmission, too, that we haven't talked about. Even mosquitoes, contaminated, and ticks, of course. And during wartime, this is when the health system breaks down considerably. Not just for the soldiers out in the field. You come to expect that. But in Stalingrad, basically, it was a metropolis that was under siege. And the power was cut off. There was no clean water. And in those desperate situations, it was perfect for the transmission of disease. But again, as I mentioned, this is nothing new. And in warfare, disease usually comes right along with it. Here's another outbreak that was suggested that could have been the result of biological warfare activity. And here again is a case of where the Crimean-Congo hemorrhagic fever, or a variant, the Xinjiang hemorrhagic fever, is endemic to certain regions. And its presence cannot necessarily be associated with biological warfare activity. In this case, Ken Albeck also made the rather startling claim that this was the result of Chinese work in biological warfare. But this article and other articles since then have basically shown that these, not in response to those charges, but just simply from the epidemiology of the disease, that through transmission by fleas, biting insects, ticks, this type of hemorrhagic fever has always been in that region, and there are peaks where there are more cases than usual. Another case would be the foot-and-mouth outbreak in Taiwan. Foot-and-mouth disease, of course, is really strictly an animal pathogen, but it's been mentioned in a biological warfare context because you can ruin your enemy's economy by going after their live animals. In this case, the pig industry, the swine industry in Taiwan no longer exists as it was. They used to have approximately 14 million head of pig. Now they're about 7 million, and they've pretty much given up on any export markets because of the outbreak of foot-and-mouth disease in 1997. Foot-and-mouth disease does not necessarily kill many pigs, although in Taiwan it was a very virulent form of the disease. But generally what presents are these vesicles along the hooves, ergo the foot, and then along the snout, ergo the mouth. So foot and mouth really affects in terms of the epidermal layers, separating the hoof from the skin, but also along the nasal and also the tongue, forming these very painful vesicles. The animals do not feed, they do not thrive, and it's an economic disaster because you cannot export so long as you have foot and mouth disease in your country. Thus, the situation in the United Kingdom being so difficult as it is, because it's such a hard thing to get rid of once it gets started. There were suggestions that perhaps the foot and mouth disease outbreak in 1997 was caused by sabotage. Why? Well, among other reasons, when they did the nucleic sequencing of the virus that was isolated, particularly from 10 farms along the coast in Taiwan, they matched a sample that was found in the mainland laboratory. Well, what does this tell us? Well, it tells us something. It certainly helps us find perhaps the source of the virus. But was it intentionally caused, or was it through smuggling? So it turns out there's a big market in mainland China and Taiwan in smuggling of products, depending on which particular phase of the economy is going. And in mainland China, price controls often lead to smuggling of many products, including meats, but also live animals. And it's fairly clear that what happened was a piglet or an infected pig that did not have overt disease was smuggled across to Taiwan to a particular farm, and that's where the disease started. And from there, because of the way pigs were distributed throughout Taiwan, and still are to this day, helped to exaggerate and to increase the amount of transmission. Pigs also excrete about 5,000 times as much virus as other animals with foot and mouth. So it was extremely infectious and very contagious. And cleanup took basically in the form of killing millions of pigs. Just as in the United Kingdom, it's basically through culling of the sheep that they're going to be able to get a hold of that epidemic. It's a very good question. And for the vaccines and foot and mouth disease, for example, is problematic. There are about 7 serotypes. None of the vaccines thus far really show great efficacy. They're fairly good in terms of perhaps stopping the disease, but they don't necessarily stop spread of the virus. Also, good manufacturing practices are necessary, because every now and then this RNA virus, particularly if they're using a live attenuated vaccine, sometimes reassort and reassert themselves in a virulent form. But foot and mouth disease is extremely hard to get a hold of. If you can think about it, it's the same basic virus in terms of its structure as the one that causes the common cold. And we haven't come close to, and we probably won't even bother trying to stop the common cold among humans, and the same problem is actually faced in dealing with these animals. Fortunately, the one good thing to say is that foot and mouth disease is not infectious in humans. Very rarely do we get it. But again, it's primarily an economic problem. And for the developed world, if you think about it, in terms of biological warfare, where, from a terrorist point of view, this is obviously a soft spot. And it's a place where we're vulnerable in a lot of ways. But this is one vulnerability that makes a lot of people, including myself, rather nervous. But as I said on the last slide, the cooperation is really important. Why? Well, in mainland China, they say they don't have foot and mouth disease. They simply don't have it. Well, I can tell you right now that in mainland China, they refer to foot and mouth disease in official parlance as disease number 5. They don't have foot and mouth disease. Of course they have foot and mouth disease. They have it everywhere. A veterinary pathologist I talked to said he visited a couple cities in mainland China, and the local vet said, oh, I've got a case up here at the street. You want to take a look at it? It's everywhere. But unfortunately, when you are a country like China and you're sensitive to this type of information, which could be damaging perhaps to your future economic performance, but also your entry into WTO, you're just going to keep quiet about that. Well, the problem is in a situation like Taiwan, it would be a little bit more helpful to be a little bit more honest about your infectious disease in your country, whether it be human or animal, to find a way to find out, one, where it came from, and two, how to prevent it in the future. So this is one of those difficulties that we are going to continue to have, particularly with many countries like Iran, North Korea, Iraq, Syria, that don't have a lot in the way of public and private exchanges with the West. And so that cooperation is going to be really vital, one, to detect outbreaks, but two, confirm that they are not the source of some kind of biological warfare activity, which makes security analysts extremely nervous and agitated. And that's one way to perhaps promote some kind of a peaceful coexistence, is to stay informed and then stay in communication about infectious disease. And we're not really very far along that respect. Now, I'd be really happy to entertain any questions that you have. I know I've covered quite a lot of material, but perhaps if you have any questions, do let me know.
This is not so much a toxicological question, more than a geography question.
Sure.
But there's a storage facility down in Umatilla, Oregon.
Yes.
And I've passed it a few times the last few months. That's why it's in my mind. Are you aware of what's in those bunkers?
Well, actually, Professor Moeller probably knows a lot more than I in terms of the actual. It seems to me they're mostly a lot of rockets, correct? They have a lot of M-55, the multiple launch rocket system, warheads, and also explosives, too, are also attached. Primarily, it's sarin. But do you have any more information on that?
All I would say is that because we have, in U.S. defense history, manufactured these materials but not used them, we actually have a store throughout the country in various locations of
chemical munitions that date back actually to World War I.
Sure.
And part of the problem in terms of decommissioning those is they've lost their labels, their rusted containers. For the most part, they've had their explosives removed, but they still essentially have the canisters associated with the chemical munitions still there. There's an issue in terms of management of that, especially of the nearby communities, of how do we decommission that? How do we remediate that without, for instance, risking any sort of release?
Challenge.
They do burn, but it's always, again, a hazard.
Yeah.
It's a not-in-my-backyard situation.
Yeah.
You don't want that to happen. But one of the problems, again, is the difference of the different types of chemicals.
Right, but in the Umatilla, for example, they have a lot of M55 rockets. One of the major problems is that there are some that are leaking, and it's figuring out which one exactly when they're stacked so closely together. Now, some of the old-timers I've talked to in the past have told me, well, I said, well, in the old days, what we do is we find a leaking rocket, and we just launch it out into the desert, let it detonate, and that took care of the problem. Well, those were the good old days, and I don't think that they can do that really much anymore. They're so sensitive about this, you know. As a matter of fact, we were talking about what happened in Colorado, where they came across one of these sarin bomblets, and they had to basically manufacture a whole facility just to destroy the one or two these errant scraps that they found in the metal yard to ensure that they were safely disposed of. I think we all know that if you're several miles away and with the dilution factor, that you've actually solved most of the problems in terms of the human hazard. However, the politics as well as just being prudent dictates that you have to be extremely careful when you're handling these really toxic substances.
Yes, how does sarin, for example, react with groundwater? I think, if I remember correctly, it's more of a volatile agent.
It is. Well, it's a very good question. I mean, it's really a liquid. It comes off at about the same amount of vapor as water. You raise a good point, and this is something actually because of the way the water systems are designed, there's the dilution factors in our favor. However, even at some ranges of pH, sarin will reside for a fair amount of time in water and would remain toxic, depending on how much was actually introduced, until it was finally hydrolyzed. And the hydrolyzes actually quite slowly. So does mustard. Now, over time, of course, eventually it comes down to a level where it's not worth talking about. But from the immediate, let's say some immediate contamination, it would exist there for a while. The key, though, is that in terms of disposal, particularly in these rockets, we're talking about a limited quantity, and it's also a containable quantity. And there's also a lot you can do in the way of decontaminating to remediate whatever runoff comes from them. I mean, you can do a lot of just bleach, sodium hydroxide, and some other compounds that will take care of the problem. But from a sabotage point of view, I think it's important for us to also consider that there are many compounds that will remain toxic, will not hydrolyze very quickly, and could be the source of some contamination. Nazi Germany had looked into using protonated nitrogen mustards, for example, as a means to contaminate water. It would certainly absorb through the gut and would cause some serious problems. That was probably before a lot of modern water handling capabilities were in place in the developed world, though. Yes, Professor?
Can they contain these things better than they had? Do they have containment systems, for example, or can they encase them or whatever it may be?
Well, there are some methods that the Soviet Union and also the United States have been working on in terms of mobilizing them in concrete or bismuth in terms of smaller quantities.
Right.
But from a larger perspective, we're still talking about concrete and steel holding the actual physical objects inside. Incineration really is the way to go. They've improved a lot in the way of scrubbers and also detection devices so that you can really have on-time, real-time monitoring of whatever toxic effluvia may be coming out of the pipe. And they had a working pilot destruction facility at Johnston Atoll out in the South Pacific that worked on a lot of different means and perfecting the methods to destroy these. But it's a real challenge, even for the United States with much more resources. Now you can imagine what it's like in the former Soviet Union with 40,000 agent tons of V-gas, Lewisite, mustard. And how are they going to do that? Well, they're not. They're not going to be doing that for a very long time. Yes, sir?
We have a habit of dumping things in the ocean.
Well, it used to be that would be the means of disposal. And in some ways, depending on the actual threat, may have been the only way to do it. France did that for many years with World War I munitions. Basically, they put primacord and explosive on a big pallet of some old World War I mustard munitions, say, put it out on the beach, let the tide come over it, and then they detonate it. Now, a lot of environmental purists would have a problem with that, maybe for good reason. But if you need to get rid of something safely and quickly, you're not left with many options. So it's either incineration or dumping it into a large dilution, like in the ocean, which you can't do anymore. So you're really stuck with either burning it or perhaps burying it in some form that neutralizes or immobilizes the compound.
By not making it.
Right, exactly. And since no one really, between the United States and Soviet Union, we've renounced chemical warfare, we don't produce it anymore. The real challenge, though, is getting rid of what we already have. And this is also a problem in mainland China. There are a lot of Japanese munitions, somewhere in the area of 1 million shells somewhere, that they have to find and remediate. And the trick is finding the chemical shells that are intermixed with ordinary ordnance. So basically what it means is any piece of metal you're going to have to probably dig up, characterize, and then destroy after many, many years and rust, and there's no markings left on the munitions. So it's a significant problem, especially for the handlers. And in the former battlefields of World War I, every now and then you'll get mustard injuries among people who are sort of picking among the ruins and come across a live mustard shell and end up with some severely blistered and burned hands. Yes, sir.
Can you briefly explain how gas mask works and explain whether like one mask could work against all these different agents that you've talked about?
That's a very good question. I think a protective mask, something that filters out very small particles, would be key for all your biological warfare agents, except one, and that's rather obscure. So for all intents and purposes, a protective mask, well fitted with a fresh filter, but one that filters out very small particles between 0.3 and up, will do the trick. The trick is keeping on to that discipline of having it on and knowing when to wear it.
But how is that filtering out the gases?
Well, that's an excellent question, and that it really doesn't. And so for the chemical threats, you would need something like that, though with the added protection of a reaction, like a reactive charcoal, activated charcoal, plus another layer that chemically reacts with cyanide. And this is something the U.S. military has had to readjust in making the new mask. Because they wanted to come up with some materials that were a little less toxic than they were before. But basically, you would chemically react with the cyanide coming in through the filter. At some point, though, that filter is going to be, quote-unquote, used up. You're going to need a fresh one. So it's a real tricky business. And then, of course, you've got the contact agents. And we've already discussed how VX can kill through the skin at about 10 milligrams. And that's, you can hardly see 10 milligrams unless you're really looking at it. So you'd really have to be fully suited. Thus, those are really the vicissitudes of chemical and biological warfare. It's really, really hard to fully protect, quote-unquote, yourself, except for just having an early warning. Do we have time for another question?
Yeah, we have time.
Oh, sorry.
One more. The comment about mask. I work with insecticides, and I will wear a full-face respirator sometimes. Hmm. You don't do too much with full-face respirators. It's hard to breathe. It's not like you have a normal life, you know. It's basically, you better be fit to wear these things, and need to be well fitted because they do exert more on your system to use them.
Making the enemy suit up is another key to the whole psychological problem in chemical warfare. Making them get up in these bulky garments, and as the professor is saying, you have these masks, and it's hard to understand what you're saying. You have to eat sometime, you have to be able to punch keyboards, and you have gloves on. And then you're, as he says, you have respirators, but then you can also wear masks, but then at which threat level do you change the filter? Do you have enough filters? How good are your suits, really? Those are the types of things that a lot of modern militaries would rather not have to deal with. And partly explains why the United States has been so concerned about getting on board the Chemical Weapons Convention, if only because of the asymmetric threat. A North Korean military manual, 1947, talks about the value of making the enemy suit up and get ready for chemical warfare, regardless of whether you are going to use it or not. You've made their logistical and operational problems even greater. Biological warfare, not much to that great extent. It's really a public health problem again. And it's something that would not have immediate effect on the enemy, but rather would be sort of over time. You could debilitate much of their infrastructure. Certainly, you know, a third or more of their soldiers might be basically incapacitated. And then some cases, you could probably just walk right on over them while they're in their hospital beds or worse. And so that was the essence of strategic use of biological warfare. From a terrorist perspective, it may just be a few isolated infections here and there that really scares the you-know-what out of people. And that's basically what has happened in terms of chemical. The sarin gas attack in Tokyo killed 12 people. It could have been a lot worse, though. And the fact that this anthrax has been mailed around this country in such finely prepared particles, that's really like sending a Ferrari engine in a Studebaker. I mean, if someone were to use this type of material, the way it's prepared, in a real munition, quote-unquote, clustered munitions or perhaps some kind of airborne delivery, you could affect many, many more infections that way. But apparently for the terrorist, it wasn't necessary because he or she or they achieved their goals already. Yes, sir?
Speaking of the sarin attack in Tokyo, I had heard that that attack did not go off as they had expected. They had planned for it to be sucked through the tubes by the motion of the trains and affect a wider area.
That may have been their ultimate goal. You have to also recall that there was a very hastily prepared batch that they made. The chemist told them, you know, this is not very pure. He dripped a little bit more isopropyl alcohol than he should have. So it was a sort of an admixture of sarin, diisopropyl fluorophosphate, and then some other things. They had nothing left, though. At that point, the cult was under siege by the authorities. They had prepared much more sarin than this before, but they had gotten rid of it. So this was sort of a last-minute slapdash operation, and they really didn't have very much, and I think they diluted it further with acetonitrile, just so that they had more volume and perhaps to make more vapor. But whatever their goals were, I think they overestimated what the effects would actually be in the end. That's a good point that you made. The key, of course, that they were trying to do was to attack the Metropolitan Police by the trains converging at one point. But it was still a disaster from the perspective of public policy. It basically shut down the whole city, if not the whole country, for a few days. Sir,
one more question.
What about those explosives that are being used while it's bombing or something? So what kind of effect it has? Any long-term effect or any immediate effect does it have?
Like, for example, conventional explosives?
Yeah,
well, that was a significant problem in World War I and later, is that off gases from conventional nitrogen explosives create a lot of nitrous oxides, and those are basically lung irritants. Now, you have some asphyxiants being produced, carbon dioxide, carbon monoxide, sometimes sulfur dioxide, but nitrous oxides as well. And that's something that can be hard to distinguish between conventional warfare and chemical warfare when many of your soldiers have this serious lung injury or are dead from no apparent cause. And that's probably what led to some of the Chinese charges in the Korean War against the United States, claiming that there was chemical warfare, because we were really loading some serious ordnance, and the likes of which they've never seen before, and probably created some lung injuries just as a byproduct of that. That's a very good point.
Well, Eric, I'd like to thank you for what I view as a very interesting and educational lecture here this morning. I think Socrates would be proud. Socrates spent his life encouraging vigorous discussion in the community arena about the problems of humanities, of humans, and then I see this as one of our biggest challenges. I'd like to thank you and present you with this plaque, the Socrates Award Lecture 2001, Chemical and Biological Warfare Agents, in thanks and cooperation to Eric Crotty. Eric,
well,
thank you very much. We appreciate this.
Overwhelmed. Thank you very much.
Thank you. And I'd like to thank you all this morning. We appreciate it. There will be a further campus discussion later this afternoon, and later this afternoon as well, another seminar that Eric is going to deliver on more of the military history of biological and chemical warfare. Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you. It's my first plaque.